This is Dialogue Conspiracy. Political research specialist Mae Brussel, whose conspiracy newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for 3 years shared with our listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and the abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary relates the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon on Dialogue Conspiracy. It's July the 15th, 1974, out here in Carmel, California. Nice day. I've been helping Don here make a commercial for Parallax View, the movie that's going to be opening up next week, a week from Wednesday, at the State Theater in our own hometown. Wherever you are, try to see Parallax View. It's the story of a newspaper man who witnessed the assassination of a presidential candidate running for election. He decided that he wanted to investigate this particular murder, and as he went to meet with the other witnesses that were present at the time of the murder, they began to die one by one. They were dying off. Maybe you see the comparisons between many of the assassinations and the subsequent deaths of fall that I've talked about on Dialogue Conspiracy these past few years. Parallax Corporation, in this particular instance, the studios don't say who they got the name from or what it is, but I know that there is the Permandex Corporation, the Swiss corporation that we've talked on Dialogue Conspiracy, that is responsible for the past political assassinations. It's a Swiss corporation. And we'll go, I've talked about it many, many shows, but I want to start out today with a news event that Jack Anderson had in the newspaper, and then maybe make a few more comments about Permandex Corporation. This is the July 15th article of Jack Anderson that goes around the country, and he's talking about Charles Colson. The lead article is Colson Talks About Extortion. And Jack Anderson made 5 points in this article that I brought up as a state of emergency in the article I did exactly 2 years ago this week in The Realist. Charles Colson is going to jail, and he has revealed to Richard Blast, we mentioned those interviews last week and the week before, he revealed a 7 days in May plan to take over the United States. He asserted that the Pentagon practiced extortion to keep Nixon from arresting the military men who stole secrets from the White House, but he made the charge of the 7 days in May. Those were the original Lewis Tapkwood plans for martial law that included the Attorney General and Assistant Attorney General Robert Mardian and Fred LaRue and the chain of command of the entire Watergate. That was the plans for Watergate, and that's the confusion about what they were doing in the Democratic headquarters. I have said before, and you will see it come out in the future, they were planting evidence to blame the Democrats and the radicals, and the military would be planning an overthrow of the United States government in Miami at the time of the Republican conventions. Charles Colson has now made the statements, which are quoted by Jack Anderson, that Richard Nixon is surrounded in the White House, that he's helpless, that the military has taken over. It says Colson feels that Mr. Nixon cannot fully trust anyone in the White House to carry out his orders, and he can't sit there with a machine gun. I said that Mr. Nixon has been the selected agent, and he is in danger, and they were out to get him, and that he is covered by the military. He is not his own boss. It is also said in today's article that Richard Nixon can't order the arrest of those people who spied on the National Security Council or the military, that they threaten him with extortion. They have extortion on him, and he cannot do anything about removing the military chiefs. That's why he had to reappoint the chief of staffs after the Watergate, when he found out that in 1971 that they were stealing papers from the National Security Council. Those men are promoted now in the Pentagon. There's 5 of them that have been promoted instead of being fired. So they have to get away with it. One of the reasons for having the White House tapes on him all the time is an extortion and a blackmail. Another charge, what we've said over and again, that I wrote about 2 years ago, that Howard Hunt, while in the White House, worked directly or indirectly with the CIA, and we've heard that on this show. And he said Mr. Nixon was also the White House, as information that the CIA had infiltrated the White House to knock off Mr. Nixon. Now, this is clarified figuratively speaking. He said whether or not they're the spy or not, they're going to knock him off. And one of the things about the Watergate, as soon as the exposures came out, Richard Nixon couldn't get rid of the military, but he compromised, and that's why Spiro Agnew was out. He was their selected president if they had killed Richard Nixon between the nominations of the Democrats and the election in November. G. Gordon Liddy walked around with an attaché case. He had entered into the White House at any time. It was wrapped up in a towel. He had a towel inside his case, and he kept his snub-nosed revolver. Howard Hunt kept his gun in the desk at the White House when they broke open. He kept a weapon. Dwight Chapin, the appointment secretary, was setting up his appointments, and I've written about and talked about a Mr. Topping in New York who had an appointment, who was going to come in the White House, who was planning to murder Richard Nixon. I always felt that Mr. Butterfield's control of the White House tapes was for the purpose of knowing where Richard Nixon would be at any time in the event they wanted to murder him, who was in the room, who they could frame, or they could send somebody in, a servant or something, that those rooms were taped because they intended to murder Richard Nixon. Fred LaRue walks in and out of the White House. He murdered accidentally his father a few years earlier. It never was indicted or named. They called it a gun accident, and Fred LaRue had weapons, which he gave Alfred Baldwin, who escorted Martha Mitchell around. He had weapons. Even though a murder had been committed in his own hands of his own father, he was the liaison from the Pentagon into the Justice Department and worked with John Mitchell and Richard Nixon. And then Robert Mardian, the Assistant Attorney General, would round up the radicals, and he kept the list, and he worked with James McCord for the Emergency Contingency Unit, and that was your martial law plan. I'm receiving a lot of mail, and people want the article I did last year and 2 years before. If you send $2 to KLRB for postage and the back articles, the three articles that I did, I'll send you those. I'm getting mail from around the country. If you send $2 to KLRB, I'll send you the past articles, and they're a guideline for the future. The truth is only beginning to come out. Well, I'm coming down now. I've been on kind of a working high. My adrenaline's been going. I've been writing that article on the SLA for a long period of time. It's at the publishers in New York. Now it's being set, printed. It'll be out in 3 or 4 weeks. I thought I would just read to you the first two pages of the way it goes and see if it interests you. The article that I turned over this last week was 194 pages. That's a book in itself. I couldn't do less and put my name to it. I thought it would just be shorter. It was 194 pages. I'll read you the first two pages, and the rest I hope you'll be getting within the next 3 to 4 weeks. The title, as I told you, is Why was Martha Mitchell? That was 2 years ago. This is Why Was Patricia Hearst Kidnapped? Or How Do You Tell a CIA Espionage Plot from a Revolutionary Radical Terrorist Guerrilla Army? Now, I hope you have your tape cassettes. A lot of you tape the shows and take down what I'm saying. I'm going to say some outrageous things, but I back them up with what I just gave you an example of the past 2 years, and I ask you the terrible question, what if I happen to be right again? So this is the way it reads, the first two pages. The kidnapping of Patricia Campbell Hearst was as vital to the creation of the Symbionese Liberation Army as the murder of Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand was to the beginning of World War I. Both the kidnapping and the murder were used as an excuse to declare war. The ensuing battles had been carefully prepared and anticipated by the merchants of death. The end goal of the SLA is World War III, to plunge the Third World masses into starvation and slavery. We have accomplished this through the CIA in 77 countries. The Third World inside the United States is the next selected victim. The SLA was nurtured inside the American prison system. This will provide the excuse to isolate prisons from future visitors, creating private Dachau's and another Auschwitz. The SLA was created in order to spread terror and fear across the country. There will be a forced response upon existing radicals. Domestic chaos will escalate. Carefully synchronized with the Hearst kidnapping in Berkeley were a series of provocateur-inspired kidnappings. Fictitious armies surfaced as far away as England. Well-dressed and well-financed Ian Ball was pretending to kidnap Princess Anne to feed the poor. After his brief moment in history, Ball was taken away to a mental hospital. The kidnapping hoax involved Jean-Paul Litt, son of a Belgian diplomat in Florence, Italy. The timing of international with national kidnappings could easily be planned to instill fear of an epidemic of abductions across the continents. In the meantime, and not by coincidence, only the poor suffer from the kidnappings and the shootings on their behalf. America's first political kidnapping was necessary to justify the creation of laws and the development of police SWAT teams. They can be later be used against legitimate guerrilla or terrorist activities. Increased repressions, planned genocide, starvation, widespread unemployment, inadequate health care and housing must necessarily provoke anger and self-defense in the face of death. Washington is preparing its defenses, its punishments, and its armies in the streets. The series of staged exploits by the SLA has created fear and suspicion, mistrust of genuine avenues of political change. Radical movements will be discredited and associated with kidnapping, terror, murder, bank robbery, and violence. Under the guise of reforms, the door is now open for increased infiltration and disruption of progressive movements. That is as much as we'll read now. That's page 2 of the manuscript. In the last week or two, we've seen the robbery in Los Angeles of the armory that was allowed by the police department. They're handing out weapons to blacks, making deals for them to kill other blacks. It's a very combustible area. You're going to see a lot of things happen. I hope that maybe by exposing some of these things on the air across the country, we can avert what we did in Miami at the time that they were planning the violence and the martial law down there. Two people were murdered in San Francisco, and their bodies were dumped in Hillsborough, the association of Hillsborough with the Hearst family where they live. There was a shooting of Martin Luther King's mother and two other people that's directly related to this large conspiracy. And there was a raid this week at the White Panthers office on Page Street in San Francisco. And the news coverage was very interesting. They said there's a strange new cult there. They're a group of food people who, it's called the Food Conspiracy. They're trying to help feed the poor to get along on their limited budgets by manipulating the stamps and cash to give them more nourishment for the same amount of money without ripping people off. And this was described as a strange cult, the White Panthers, that were doing this kind of thing. And the news media said this cult have some characteristics in common. They smoke marijuana, they like rock music, and they're loose sexually. So the assault on the radicals, you see, the rock music thing, the rock musicians have been systematically been murdered in the last 10 years. The loose sex, we're going into a tight period of repression if we allow it. And the marijuana, if you classify under those three, and you're still not politically radical, if you don't belong to the Vietnam Veterans Against the War or a target list of the National Security Council, if you don't belong to any specific category, but you smoke marijuana, are loose with your sex, and like rock music, that becomes a category or a cult, as of the media this week. Last week on the Dialogue Conspiracy, I talked about Supreme Court decision that newspaper people and reporters could not necessarily visit specific prisoners and have interviews with them. You can go in if they give you permission, but if they don't want you in, you don't have to go into the prison. They don't have to let you into the prison. And the reasoning on the Supreme Court is that the prisoner has the right to send letters out and that he can tell what's happening. Therefore, the newsman does not have to go into the prison because members of the family don't get inside the prison. So on the basis of that, last week I read two letters on KLRB and said I do this every week. And I read two letters from Soledad Prison in California, because even though this show plays in other states or cities, this is the famous prison where Donald DeFries walked out of there. I wouldn't dignify it with the word escape. He walked out of there with assistance. And I read letters from two men and mentioned a man whose life was in danger, Robert Hyde, and I mentioned another man's life who was in danger because he wouldn't kill Robert Hyde. Our program at KLRB went off the air at 6 o'clock on Monday, last Monday, and at 9:15, the prisoner I talked about, Robert Hyde, was chained and transferred to Folsom Prison in California, and another prisoner was put in solitary confinement. He was in solitary confinement, and his life was threatened. And a letter came out to a lawyer, and I'm asking men in prisons, wherever they are in this country, if they are offered, if they're in on a large sentence and they're offered to get out on the street if they'll murder an inmate, or if they're put in a hole with false charges and told they'll get out if they murder an inmate. If your life is in danger, either write to me directly, or if I don't answer you within 2 weeks, write the same time to your lawyer and have him mail it to me. And I'm accumulating these letters, and I'm getting ready with several researchers for a lawsuit against the California Department of Corrections, specifically for certain murders and for certain threats of murder, and we're formulating the lawsuit at the present time. And Alan Wilson wrote that he was chained and taken to O-Wing. He said they heard me on the radio out at Soledad, and his life was in danger. And he mentioned what happened. He said that June 19th in 1974, that was just a couple of weeks ago, a sergeant took him to the chow hall. I won't read his name on the air, but I did call the prison about it. And they went through his C file, and they said that he could get parole if he murdered this particular prisoner, and they gave him a knife. And when he didn't want to do it, he was beat up by another officer in the kitchen, and he was afraid of his life because he would not accept the offer of lighter charges if he would murder out at Soledad. There's going to be a lot of deaths in the prison systems in California because a lot of men knew Donald DeFreeze. The case is pretty cut and dried about how DeFreeze got to Soledad, how he got to the boiler room, so they can stop killing people out there. They don't have to keep murdering to hush it up. There's enough evidence now for a lawsuit on that particular matter, so the prison officials who are listening don't have to go killing everybody because they're only going to compound their particular problem. I called the warden up at Folsom, where Hyde was moved, Robert Hyde. I called out at Soledad. And as a matter of fact, it was very funny. The warden at Folsom said I was on drugs. He said, "Woman, you're on psychedelic drugs. You're a comic character." He says, "You have to be kidding." I said, "No, go look at Robert Hyde's eye when I was burned out. I went in the circumstances." I said, "You may think I'm comic, but I'm going to place a lawsuit against the prison system if you continue to do this kind of thing." And then the lawyers later did speak to the warden, and he said this crazy woman on psychedelic drugs called and was concerned. But they know what they're doing, and they know that I don't have any drugs in my house. I've stayed away from marijuana or acid or anything in my home or been near it, so that in case I wanted to be discredited by these particular authorities who know better, they can't place somebody into my home and bring these things and then say that they've been used in my home. One of the officers at Soledad Prison paid me the highest compliment of the week, though I have to tell you. He asked me why I was bothering them by calling out to O-Wing. He said, this is his quote. He says, "The trouble with you is that you get up in the morning and you have nothing to do with yourself." He said, "All you're interested in is saving lives." He says, "You have to think about saving lives all the time." He says, "That's how you get your kicks." And I said, "Thank you very much. That's the highest compliment I've gotten this week. That's exactly why I'm doing this program, and that's why I care. And I will continue to harass you until you stop playing the games inside your prisons that you are doing and get back to the job of rehabilitating people instead of offering them goodies to murder other inmates." There was an article this week about San Quentin, an escapee who left San Quentin. He's going to be brought back from Victoria, British Columbia. But then there was another interesting comment in the San Francisco Chronicle today. It said Marley Pearson, 35, had left San Quentin, and they referred to him as a new walk away from San Quentin, minimum security risk. I know that somebody is listening to these programs every week because I refer in my long article as the walkaways, and now the media picked it up, and they don't call them escapees. They're calling them walkaways to act like this is their usual terminology, where they've always been referred to as escapes before. The next part of this program, we're going to mostly talk about Earl Warren, who passed away, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. I wanted to do the whole show about him, but I did want to make one comment because I want to do another show. We've talked at different times about the Pope, the current Pope. He has a denial this week in a newspaper in the Vatican, Pope Paul VI, that he's not a member of the CIA and doesn't receive funds from the CIA, and he quotes Victor Marchetti, referring to Pope Giovanni Battista Montini as a Monsignor who received CIA funds in 1950 and 1960. And those of you who've listened to Dialogue Conspiracy know that I've talked about this Pope as being a member of the OSS and being part of the espionage establishment ever since he was a cardinal. As a matter of fact, I've even said matters worse. I got information of a death of the Pope before Pope John that involved this Montini, the current Pope, in order to escalate his position. And this, the Pope at the time had said, don't ever let Montini work his way up. He was a cardinal because he was feared and he was dangerous. And one of the other predecessors had disappeared. His death had been untimely and suspicious. And now Victor Marchetti has written a book on the cult of intelligence and his the fact that this Pope took money from the CIA. It has a lot to do with international drug traffic. I'm not anti-Catholic, and it may shock you. It ties in with the allegations just on the news this week of Robert Vesco and drug officials and international money going back and forth. And I don't like to duplicate or backtrack shows unless they pertain to the current news, but I would like to do about a 20 or 30 minute summary of the drug traffic and the Vatican and Aristotle Onassis and Robert Vesco. It's a dirty story because it is the use of the OSS and the CIA to take every place of high office and find the people, manipulate the people through murder to position of power, or the people who get the power are associated with death in some very unsolved ways, and people who've worked in the agencies are disclosing the relationship of those individuals to those deaths. And on that subject, it's fitting that we give the Earl of Warren a good send-off. I call him the Earl of Warren. The nobility, he's one of the biggest put-ons of Americans' politics since, I guess, Eugene McCarthy is the same ilk. The liberal, the CIA front, the manipulator. A lot of eulogies written about Earl Warren. I take 8 papers a day. I looked through them this week. There was only one mention out of the 8 papers. At Los Angeles Times had a full-page article, only one mention of the Warren Commission report. Imagine the President of the United States was murdered in the United States of America. The most thorough investigation the history of our government has ever done, and his name they don't even want to associate it with that document because there wasn't a moment of truth in the document. Warren Burger, the new Chief Justice, said that Earl Warren's life is the epitome of U.S. dream. Well, I think we ought to change our dreams. If he's the epitome of our dreams, let's change our dreams. You can list a lot of things that have happened since Earl Warren was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He had his moment of history where he made a few changes, but the changes are all being turned back. Nothing is happening. We're going into the worst period of repression, starvation, loss of rights of prisoners. He sold that out because he took the position of covering the hardcore Nazis, the people behind the Permandex Foundation, which is the parallax in that movie. He covered them all up, all the evidence, when he was doing his work as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, not 10 years later. All that evidence was available there, and I'll read you some of the evidence of the way they covered up the Warren Commission report. I think as a eulogy to Earl Warren, I'd like to read 2 poems to give him a good send-off. One is called The Stockyards Perfume by Carl Sandburg. They're both by Sandburg. Maybe I sound a little bitter by Earl Warren, but I've spent 10 years, they've been 10 short years, and they've been 10 long years, untying all the little threads because his name lent dignity to a piece of junk. And he let it be there because our American innocence is such that we believe that our father, our pope, our president, our chief justice are obeying the law. We believe they're telling the truth. And it's so obnoxious to people to believe that behind that robe of Earl Warren or any of these people, that they play these other roles, that it's hard to just stay with existing evidence of conspiracy because the image of the cardinal and these high ups, the popes, the presidents, are so fantastic and played by such, proclaimed by everybody as being great, that it's very hard to find where they erred and how devilish they were. And so I am bitter about them. And the only eulogy I can give before I read some letters of the Warren Commission lawyers to each other as a send-off to the Earl of Warren are two poems. One is called, as I said, with Stockyard's Perfume. What is a judge? Another owns no more than the little finger of himself. Another owns the other part of him. Others having placed him where he is. Others telling him what they want and getting it. Others referring to him as our judge, as though he measured and weighed beforehand, the same as a stockyard hog. Others holding him decisions evasive or right or wrong. Others writing his decisions for him. The atmosphere hushed and guarded. The atmosphere having a faint stockyard's perfume. That's from the people, yes. Earl Warren didn't have to head the Warren Commission. President Lyndon Johnson said, you're going to head it. And he cried. He didn't want it. He said, the country needs it. You're going to do it. He relied upon him. But they had things on Earl Warren, too, his political career, how he came up as a youth from California, where he lived in Bakersfield. We'll talk about what they had on Earl Warren. I'll just do one more poem first. It's called Taken for a Ride. In the light of the cold glimmer of what everybody knows, why should the owners of judges speak of respect for law and sanctity of the Constitution when they know so well how justice has been taken for a ride and thrown and gagged and beaten into a ditch? That's by Carl Sandburg, too. Earl Warren had an interesting political career. He was put into power by Murray Chotiner, the wheeler, the dealer, the selected Richard Nixon. He was a team in California. Nolan of the China lobby that worked with Chiang Kai-shek, Senator William Nolan, Earl Warren, and Murray Chotiner. They worked their way up. They were buddies. And Richard Nixon squeezed Earl Warren out as vice president. He wanted to be vice president at the 1952 convention. And Nixon had pulled his little tricks. He'd gotten a train in advance and had pictures of the candidate and excluded Warren's picture. And there was a competition there because Richard Nixon had his team select, they had selected him to be the vice president in 52 under Eisenhower. And there was a bitter strain between the two for a while because Earl Warren had taken consideration of the nomination in that he would have the most active role of any vice president. But he worked with Murray Chotiner and Melvin Belli, Jack Ruby's lawyer, and in his files, which are now missing, of the Richard Nixon, when they opened up his files, which he said they could have after he was dead, there was another little quickie of disappearing evidence. The Richard Nixon file is going. He worked closely with Murray Chotiner and Melvin Belli. Isn't it funny that Jack Ruby's lawyer should be working closely all the years with Earl Warren? When you consider the role that Jack Ruby was begging to tell Earl Warren in Dallas, Texas, what happened about the conspiracy. And Warren said, I have to leave now, and I haven't got time to hear that story. I'll read you some of those words. Earl Warren started at law school in California, and he worked as a district attorney in Alameda County. And in 1925, he was a district attorney there for 13 years. In 1938, he had a four-year term as attorney general. I got a kiss here from Chuck. Okay, Chuck, what do you want? Okay, back to Dialogue Conspiracy. Earl Warren was elected in 38 in California as the Attorney General, the only Republican in a Democratic landslide. Now, 1938 was an important year in Earl Warren's life. He began as our Attorney General. But if you look up articles of December in the Los Angeles Times, there was a story on Sunday morning. Matthias Warren passed away. This was Sunday morning, May 15th, 1938. He passed away. He was a wealthy real estate man. He used to work for the railroad. The image of Warren in the obituaries this week tells about his poor father who came to this country. He was bludgeoned to death, and the circumstances of the crime and the importance of Warren's career were brought close together. Warren was beginning to be the Attorney General of the state, and his father was killed in Bakersfield, California. A man named Robert Powers was chief of police in charge of the investigation, and the pressure on Powers was terrific. And you researchers look up what happened in Bakersfield, California. Maybe you'll understand why we had the Warren Report. Powers recalled, he said, Warren at that time had already gained considerable popularity among the peace officers. There were mystery witnesses. I'm reading a newspaper article about Earl Warren that came out in 1968, and I have other articles, too. There were mystery witnesses and other stereotypes of the usual unsolved murder cases, and the disclosure of a purported violent argument late in the night of the murder. And Earl Warren's father was murdered with a pipe that split him on the back of his head, and the murderer got into the house some way and seemed to know the house. There was no struggle, it seemed. The overt motive was a robbery. The case was never cleared. The person in charge of the investigation allegedly was Earl Warren, who directed the investigation. The mystery of the murder of his father remains. Behind power, it sounds ugly, behind power are so many of these deaths, and I've had articles on this particular thing. I'm not saying how it happened, but it's an interesting saga that this man was linked in several articles way back, long before I was making a lot of other connections between the way power moves. Now, Earl Warren became the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in 1960. He retired in 69, of June of 69. But as a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Lyndon Johnson gave him an executive order, a mandate, which was a thorough and independent investigation. He was to put to rest all assertions or rumors relating to the conspiracy or the complicity of others that involved Lee Harvey Oswald or the death of Officer Tippit or President John Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. And he had all the powers they needed. At the Warren Commission hearings, they subpoenaed witnesses in private. It wasn't an open hearing. Earl Warren was the one who didn't want it in the open, and they didn't put any of the doubts to rest. Jack Ruby saw Earl Warren, and this is part of the dialogue from Volume 5 that I've mentioned at other times. He said to Earl Warren, "Get me out of Washington if you can't. Get me to Washington if you can't. You won't get a fair shake out of me. I'm not a crackpot. I don't want to evade any crime. And it's too bad, Earl Warren, you didn't get to me sooner." And he begs Earl Warren. He says, "Let me tell you what happened. Let me get to Washington and tell you how it was done." And Warren said, "No, it couldn't be done. It can't be done. There are many things involved." And Ruby said, "What?" And he said, "The public attention it would attract." He said, "It is our responsibility to go into anything of that kind. It isn't, and we don't have to go into it." And Jack Ruby begged Earl Warren to tell what happened in Dallas. And you know, last week on our show, or the week before, I was reading information that Jack Ruby's stripper, Tammy True, housed one of the assassins, several of them, that left Dallas after the assassination of John Kennedy, and that Jack Ruby was involved in the conspiracy. And he begged Earl Warren, he said, "Please let me tell you what happened." This is page 181 of Volume 5. And Earl Warren said, "We've taken your testimony here. We have it. It'll be permanent for the president and the Congress." And Ruby says, "You've lost me, though. You've lost me, Chief Justice Warren. I won't be around for you to come and question me." Ruby said, "If I am being used as a scapegoat and if I am eliminated, there won't be any way of knowing that I have been used for a purpose." And Earl Warren said, "Well, we've taken your testimony." And Ruby says, You've lost me. You don't understand, Mr. Chief Justice Earl Warren." And Earl Warren leaves, and Jack Ruby was murdered. And the attorney for Jack Ruby, Melvin Belli, was an associate of Earl Warren's, and he knew that. The National Archives were locked up on the orders of Earl Warren. Again, the Pentagon, the same military that owns Richard Nixon, that gives the orders, the same Pentagon that owns him, decided the arbitrary date of the Warren Commission evidence to come out would be the year 2037. A Mr. Winokur from the Pentagon sent the historians to write the Warren Report from the Pentagon. Charles Colson has given enough today in the news for people who are listening, who care, who want to stop a martial law, to write to various officials or send telegrams, and let's find out who in the Pentagon is doing these things. We have their names. It isn't that vague or open. And Earl Warren sat as the chief of the Warren Commission and lent his name to a document. Now, what were his alternatives? He had a lot of alternatives. He could have, as I say before, he could have turned it down. I have copies of the first meeting of the Warren Commission, December the 5th. This is Earl Warren talking to members of the commission. These meetings are in the National Archives on microfilm. He said, I am of the opinion that we should not conduct our hearings in public. It's not necessary to bring witnesses before us. It is not necessary to get the story of witnesses unless we get it through investigative agencies first. And you see, it was the Pentagon that investigated it first. He said, he goes on to say that there is evidence of, if there is evidence of great conspiracies, people will spread rumors. They will say, I knew this or that. I have evidence that people are having tales. Good many people would like to be witnesses at our hearings. This is Warren. And he said, if we have them, someone who has visions that were told to them exactly what happened in this situation or believe they knew of great conspiracies, we'd have public meetings and witnesses in public, and we'd be quite sure that some of these people would try to force themselves on us. If we don't use them in public, they would claim we suppressed their evidence and we only took what we agreed to do. So we shouldn't have any of these people. The witnesses should be carefully screened, you see, by the Pentagon first. And then they will write the questions for them and screen them out. This was the minutes of the Warren Commission from the very first meeting, December the 5th, tell you that Earl Warren was part of the secret team. Then he said it regarding Mrs. Kennedy. This is Earl Warren, December 16th meeting. He said, you can talk to someone like Mrs. Kennedy. I think you ought to know exactly what we want to find out from her and exactly what we have to have from her. In other words, don't let her speak. She did give a lot of testimony which was not used by the Warren Commission, which is locked up. But we will tell her what we want from her, and we will tell her what we have to have from her. And the rest was locked up for the till the year 2037. It's supposed to be till no one alive at the time of the Kennedy assassination would have access to that material. They have to be dead. The next generation, if there is one, would have access to that. But then there'd be new laws later, I'm sure. The Warren Commission met on January the 21st, and Earl Warren was at the meeting, and they were talking about material they'd have to go through. And Earl Warren says, I think we have to get this behind us. It's the middle of a campaign year, and it would be bad for the country to have this thing discussed at that particular time. And Mr. Rankin, the chief attorney for the Warren Commission, said, I think it would take 30 days to read and digest it. This is 26 volumes, 26 million pages, and there's more locked up, and they want 30 days to read it and digest it. He said, maybe we could have 45 days. That's the way the Warren Commission did their work. They had decided in one day that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin, and then they stretched it out all the other days. Well, I have letters from the Warren Commission lawyers to each other, and this is the kind of material that was in the hands of Earl Warren. Some of it I've read at my college class, some I've read on KLRB before, and I think it's very important to go over it now, because Earl Warren is getting this wonderful send-off as doing so much for this country. And I can't see that his decision to hide the conspirators, to hide Permandex, and the setup of the political assassinations isn't going to bring us down into a period like the Middle Ages if we don't rally and use our strength and resources to fight these evil people. He protected them, and how can you give him such a good send-off? He protected the Solidaris, the emigre group that brought in Marina Oswald, the Sirhan family, the American Council of Churches with H.L. Hunt, the Free Cuba Committee with Carlos Prius Siqueiros that involves the Cubans that were going to do the martial law 10 years later down in Miami. He had Division 5 of the FBI. All this was available to Earl Warren, and he decided in 45 days and the rest of the time. The minutes of the Warren Commission meetings were, how do we hide this conspiracy? How do we answer the news media? How do we answer Mark Lane or Mr. Jostin, who is writing a book in Europe? How do we put the lid on all of this? We don't want them to know what's going on. I have memos of the Warren Commission from, this is May the 14th, 1964. The United States Information Agency, signed by Carl T. Rowan. On the Warren Report, when the Warren Report comes out, here's one by Robert Greene, too. Carl Rowan said, when the report of the President's Commission is released, this was July 13th, we want to do whatever we can to give its conclusions widest possible publicity abroad. There'll be a briefing center in Washington, D.C., and the press corps will be there. They made a memo, the public at this time is an unfocused audience with regard to the commission. When the commission speaks for the first time, world attention will be suddenly focused on it. Whatever the commission says at this point will be important news and get wide coverage. Every detail becomes feature material. Its reception will be based on two factors. We have to call in the foreign press. They listed several hundred groups of the foreign press. They said we're limited. The choices are to limit the issue to the report without any advance preface at all. B, to ignore the attacks on the credibility of the report that will follow it. Or three, to use the preface approach with high publicity value of the commission's first utterance. They could either just print their darn report, they could ignore the attacks that it wasn't credible, that were coming out already, or they would have this wide coverage. So the decision was to have this wide media coverage so that everyone would know. And then any criticisms that followed it wouldn't get on the major media, and they haven't been on for 10 years. A few things came on, but they were covered up and very quickly or put down, like the Jim Garrison opening up of the links of Clay Shaw, who belonged to the Permandex Corporation and worked with Lee Harvey Oswald and David Ferry in New Orleans. All of that was discredited by the major media. The story of Oswald in Mexico, the relationship of Jack Ruby to that group that I read a few weeks ago on the news. I've mentioned this letter of the Warren Commission. It's a letter dated September the 22nd before, because Mexico is so important. E. Howard Hunt was the case officer down in Mexico City when Oswald was there. They used an apartment where Clay Shaw was working, and in a hotel that Oswald stayed with, there were people involved in the CIA operation. But the Warren Commission has a letter from one of their lawyers, David Slauson, to Howard Willens, dated September the 22nd, and the Warren report is going to be published 1 week later. And it said, we have substitute authority from the FBI as to Chapter 6 about the Hotel Del Comercio where Oswald was. Slauson said, I have inserted a phantom commission exhibit number, which will be filled in with something, and I believe I have fudged the text sufficiently so that almost anything can be fitted in. That's commission exhibit CE3074. They not only fudge it, but they admit they're fudging it. Who was the man, Mr. Slauson, who's fudging all these things? He comes from the Warren Commission meetings in December. I see Gerald Ford talking about Mr. Slauson, the December 16th meeting, and he said he's a constituent. His father from Michigan is a fine lawyer in my hometown. And this young Slauson, who's fudging and changing the phantom exhibits that involve Oswald in Mexico City, W. David Slauson, is the son of a constituent of Gerald Ford, and he was very familiar with Mr. W. David Slauson from Michigan. I have letters about the Warren Commission on the section of conspiracy of Jack Ruby, who fits in with Lee Harvey Oswald in Mexico and New Orleans connections. And in Chapter 6, there was a question, again, from Bert Griffin to Howard Willens, and it said, we can't really say that Jack Ruby was not part of a conspiracy inasmuch we haven't gone into it. But what they said, inasmuch as Ruby is still alive and dickering for his fate, it is a mistake for the commission to make any statement which indicates the investigation has been exhaustive. So the way we will word it is that as far as we have investigated, we have not uncovered any incidents of a conspiracy involving Jack Ruby. But to make further suggestions that no one aided or encouraged Ruby is a risk we don't want to incur. That was dated August 14, 1964, Bert Griffin to Mr. Willens. They have no evidence of a conspiracy of Ruby because they haven't looked for it. But they can't say there isn't any, so the legal riding, if you saw 125 lawyers involved in the Watergate, look how many CIA lawyers, and they all were CIA lawyers for the Warren Commission. They were writing a letter. As far as we investigated, we found no evidence of a conspiracy. I have a letter here to the Warren Commission written in February about Marina Oswald and all the lies that she told, and that her image was to give one kind of a person, where she repeatedly, this letter says that, you and I do not have any desire to smear the reputation of any individual, but we cannot ignore that Marina Oswald repeatedly lied to the Secret Service, the FBI, the Commission on Matters of Vital Concern to the People of this country and the world. And then another letter saying that Marina Oswald, if she wasn't truthful, would shed an entirely new light on the investigation. Well, that is the Warren Report. His name bears it. The responsibilities we're seeing today, I put under his legal cloak, the Chief Justice of the United States, part of a criminal conspiracy so gigantic that it created the SLA 10 years later, and now we have another compound of kidnappings, hijackings, and violence by the same team that gave us the John F. Kennedy assassination. That's it for today. Our time is up. I'll see you next week on KLRB. Keep well.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for over 10 years has been researching the facts behind the political assassinations in this country so that the truth may be revealed. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.